Well, they say being a goalkeeper can be lonely at times. Well, this week, both Joe Forrester and Matt Beadle have deserted me, so I am here to fend for myself. We do, however, have a fantastic show for you, with our special guest being the first goalkeeper to captain his team in an FA Cup final, the first goalkeeper to save a penalty in an FA Cup final, and the first goalkeeper to miss 3 months of football due to a salad cream-related injury. We will, of course, be talking to the one and only Dave Besson. Welcome to the Goalkeepers Union podcast. You can, of course, reach us at GK Union on Twitter, GK Union Official on Instagram, or search GK Union on Facebook in association with GK Icon, or send us an email, hello@goalkeepersunion.net. So without any further ado, welcome Dave Besson.
Hi, Rich.
Well, there's only one place to start. Massive game, of course, a game that defined your career. I am, of course, talking about the Zenith Data Systems Cup 1990. You beat Middlesbrough.
Yeah, it was a trip to Wembley, and in those days, Chelsea hadn't had much chance to win silverware. Zenith Data competition wasn't, it was a relatively new competition, and for us to get to the final was a big thing. And actually, it was an even bigger occasion because on that day, we was actually making the World Cup record for 1990, and because of the Zenith Data Cup final, I managed to keep my voice off of the England World Cup record.
Oh, is that right?
That's true. That's the point. Me and Tony Dorigo.
Ah, I did not know that. Well, of course, the game that did eclipse that was the 1988 FA Cup final. We're going to talk about more of that in detail a little bit later on, because I'm sure our listeners really want to know exactly what happened that day. And there's so many reasons why it's such a famous cup final for you personally and obviously for Wimbledon. But we've got to start with where it all began, the Crazy Gang. There was a documentary recently on BT Sports and they spoke a lot about the Crazy Gang. And I saw a quote recently from Neil Ardley where he said, if the Crazy Gang happened now, we'd all be in prison. I'm sure you must have some stories. Are there any that stand out in particular?
I just think it was the uniqueness of the football club. As you say, the documentary was out. I thought it was a fantastic documentary up to a point.
Okay.
You know, the early years of it where, you know, we were coming through the divisions, you could see what was going on in the background. You know, I mean, we was the media's fodder because, you know, we come from nowhere. Nobody knew who we were, but we were trying to make our name both in the fact that we were trying to achieve something with a football club, but also we wanted people to know who we were. And so whenever there was something going on and the press, the TV needed a team or individuals to do something fairly silly, they come knocking on our door knowing we was game for anything. And so, you see a few things in the early stage of the documentary, but then, you know, we had a few characters that liked to try and push their profile. And Fash being one of those type of people. And there was things that were brought, unfortunately, were brought into documentary. And the documentary was about the time leading up to the cup final and the cup final. And there was things that were brought into the documentary that actually happened after the cup final, that actually happened after I left the club. And it was as if it didn't involve me directly, but the fact that they were saying things that went on. And I don't think the group of people that was at the club at that time would have let the things go on that people were talking about at that time.
Well, you mentioned one of the names there, John Fashanu. He's obviously quite an eccentric character, but he seems to have grown a little bit more odd with age. Is that fair? Do you still speak to him?
Fash is one, I think if we bump into each other, we say hello and that, but we've not exchanging numbers and I changed my number, here's my new number. We're not on that type of terms. And that's what I say, Fash, he was quite a personality himself. When he came to Wimbledon, he was a big signing. I mean, Fash was perfect for Wimbledon. You know, we couldn't have found a better striker, centre forward to play that we played and lead the line as he did. And he was perfect for us. But, you know, I think in that documentary, you see a piece where Dave Bassett was walking along the beach and saying, Fash, I love you, but if I went to another club, I don't know whether I'd take you with me because you're suitable for the way we play, but maybe not the type of centre forward that I'd want if I went somewhere else.
Mm. Yeah, interesting. Something that I believe came up in the documentary about the circle, you explain what the circle was and were you ever in the circle?
I never actually got being in the middle, because what it was it, we used to play like in the mornings, you know, like you have the keep ball, we have the circle, and it's done, you know, more or less on a Friday. You know, a lot of teams have a keep ball in a square, we had the circle, but we used to call it vendetta ball.
Right.
Where if you had a little vendetta, there was things going on, and then at the end of it, if there was something that was just simmering under the surface, you'd get in the middle of the circle and you'd sort it out. Mm-hmm. And that didn't matter whether you were, you know, the kit man, you know, the senior pro, the manager. And it got to the stage where, you know, Bobby Gould, the manager, and Dennis Wise had a little bit of a disagreement. And so we got them in the middle of the circle, and you're thinking, well, it won't really go down this one. But it did. It got to the stage where they had a little wrestle in the middle, and I think Wisey cracked one of Bobby Gould's ribs.
Really? You see, there's something to that where I think now, I mean, you know, I've had it at football clubs where you get an issue, and what ends up happening is you end up getting lots of cliques. Certainly when something's going wrong in a team, then a team will start to separate, and you have a load of cliques, and they'll all be having their own conversation. To some extent, there's an argument to be said that having an idea like the circle makes sense.
Well, I mean, exactly what you're saying there, and that's what I was indicating a little bit earlier, the fact that if we had that circle, the situation with Fash, the situation arose with Fash and Laurie Sanchez, and it was after the cup final, but it got clicky. You know, as I said, I'd left the club, new players had come in, and other players had moved along, and there was an incident that happened that the two of them kind of had a fight. Mm. And it shouldn't have got to that stage. It shouldn't have got to the stage where, you know, things happen that happen. I mean, I say I wasn't there, so I don't know firsthand, but I know, you know, indirectly from people talking to me what happened. And like I say, that was brought into the documentary, which I didn't like too much.
Mm. I want to ask you about the Magaluf shuffle. If you could elaborate. I was sent some footage, and it was quite interesting watching some of the lads do this Magaluf shuffle after scoring goals. There was one particular game for yourself against Bury. You saved a penalty, and it looked like you were about to go into the Magaluf shuffle, but you didn't quite. You went into more of a gentlemanly handshake.
Yeah, well, you know the score, Richard. The goalkeepers don't celebrate too often and get that stage where you can go a bit looping. And at the end of every season, with Wimbledon, we used to go away on an end-of-season tour, not pre-season tour. You know, we used to do it back to front, and we were going to Magaluf. It was one of our destinations, Magaluf. And that game you're talking about, we played Bury away. And I think we'd won the title previously, but we actually got the trophy that day. Mm. And we said, right, it was on the TV, we're going to do the Magaluf shuffle. When you score, you've got to do the Magaluf shuffle. So it wasn't coming into the equation that I would actually do the Magaluf shuffle, because, you know, I'm not going to score. But it arose that I saved the penalty, and that's about the limit of my dancing. So you see the best of me there.
You certainly gave it a little bit of a go, to be fair. One of the big talking points of the Dave Bassett era was the fact that you as a team, of course, you were quite direct. I think that's fair to say. Laurie Sanchez said they'd pass it back to you from kickoff. You'd launch it so far that the first bounce would almost be on the edge of the opposition's penalty box.
Yeah, it was. I mean, Sanchez, he came to us from Reading, and he was, you know, he always lets people know that when he signed, he was known as a ball-playing midfielder. Mm. But then when he came to Wimbledon, he was told, if you have any more than two touches, you'll be dragged off and things like that. So, but there was, you know, it was a ploy, the way we played, that the ball would come back to me and we would go along. So from as you say, kickoff, it would come back to me, give everyone a chance to push up. I'd put it as far as I could, aiming for Fash, get the bits in, you know, around the edge of their box and take it from there. Mm. I think in the season where we actually won the FA Cup final, I'm sure the stats were something like assists for goals were Dennis Wise with his set plays, because obviously we were a team that worked, you know, wasn't, you know, people, I don't think, gave us the credit that we were due, because we knew exactly what we were doing. It wasn't just play long balls. It was a ball into an area. So it was a pass into an area. It probably wasn't a 20-yard pass or, you know, as you're seeing these big diagonal passes now that look fantastic, but it was a pass into an area. And then with our set plays, we'd work on things and, you know, we had Fash, we had two big centre-halves, and we knew what we was doing. And so I don't think people gave us the credit that we actually were very well coordinated and very well drilled in what we were actually doing. And obviously, for me to put balls into an area where whether we win it or lose it, it can be a threat to the opposition. And that's what we've done.
Yeah, well, my memory, I mean, we obviously worked together for a brief period of time when you came into Watford. And I always remember you're quite ahead of your time, certainly when it came to cross-taking and kicking. And of course, with Wimbledon being quite direct, was there quite a lot of pressure on you to be accurate with your kicking?
Yeah, I mean, obviously, that, you know, we were talking out of the hands because that was the way to get the ball the furthest, because obviously you're starting at the edge of the 18-yard box, and I was probably kicking it to 4 or 5 yards outside the opposition 18-yard box with a volley. But then if Fash is starting on the right side of the pitch, it's no good of me hitting on the left side of the pitch where, you know, we might have Dennis Wise on that side. So, you know, you had to be accurate to an extreme. But then again, the ball is travelling, you know, 70-odd yards, so there's a chance for, if it's 10, 15 yards offline, for someone to be able to make a run and you know, challenge or compete for the ball. The next phase was, and I thought that Dave Bassett was you know, on a wind-up, because he actually said to me, and this was before, you know, we see it nowadays all the time, but he said to me, I want you to dribble the ball out of the box. Mm. And I was kind of, you know, what do you mean? And, you know, you've got the ball in your hands. When they've all pushed back, expecting you to kick the ball out of your hands, I want you to put the ball down and dribble it out of your box and see what they do. And then when they start closing down, because now you will be able to hit accurately and you will be able to hit Fash on the edge of their box, and he will win the header and head it into the, you know, the danger area where the other people are going to be coming to attack the second phase. So that was the next thing that we suddenly started doing, was dribbling the ball out. And when the manager gives you a license, as we see to the extreme today, where goalkeepers are playing it out and taking such risks, because the manager is saying it, and the manager is saying more or less, I'll hold my hand up. If we can see the goal from playing out of the back, I'll say it's my fault and I want you to keep playing like it. But if you keep making mistakes, or not necessarily making mistakes, but if you keep getting punished for playing out of the back, whether it's your fault or whether it's the defender you've given it to losing the ball and then you're wide open, it will start to affect you if you keep conceding goals. Whether or not the manager's holding his hand up or you're holding your hand up, it will affect you. And it got to a situation where, because the manager has said to me, you dribble the ball out, I can remember once taking the ball and having the team that's attacking behind me, and because I'm quite close to the edge of the box, I'm thinking, right, put the ball down, and started dribbling. And they're so I've got opposition players in front of me and opposition players behind me. I'm thinking, what am I doing? but it's just in my mindset, right, now I can put the ball down and play. I didn't start playing in goal until I was 16.
Right.
So I used to be a centre forward. So, you know, all goalkeepers are think they can play up front at any level. And I really actually was given that chance to actually put the ball down and start playing in league games, which I loved.
Just on that note, because we had Ben Foster on recently, he was also very late into goalkeeping. In fact, he was a chef until he was 18, I believe. Yeah. Obviously, still going now, still going strong at 36. Do you think the fact that you didn't only started playing in goal at the age of 16 was one of the reasons you went on as long as you did?
It's been a sort of my mind is exactly that, Rich, that because I started late, I didn't, and I wonder whether goalkeepers starting young and being coached at the age of, you know, 7, 8, 9 goalkeeping, whether their longevity will fade, you know, because they've started too young. Like you're saying, I started as an outfield player. I loved playing out on pitch. And then I got the goalkeeping bug and I started playing in goal, and I love playing in goal. And I feel that, you know, I don't know whether people agree with me, that I was still getting better as I was getting older.
Yeah.
And I feel that because I understood the game more, because I was now more mature, and I thought I was better, probably at my best in my latter years.
Something I want to talk to you about is goalkeeping captains, because it's quite rare even now to have a goalkeeper as a captain. And of course, there were some real characters in the Wimbledon side. You were captain. That must have been some recognition from the manager, but perhaps more so from the players.
Yeah, it was, you know, it ended up being a massive honour and a massive part of me, you know, in your career, especially with Wimbledon, the fact that it ended up being captain of the winning cup final team. You know, in the early years at Wimbledon, there was more senior players that had more experience than me that were at the club that they were the captain. But then I think Dave Bassett was looking, and I mean, I went from when I got in the team at Wimbledon So when I left Wimbledon, of playing every game, every game, every week, I played. And I used to tell the boys when I'm coaching them, but I would play on a Saturday against Manchester United in the first team, and then play on a Tuesday for the reserves at Barnet because we didn't have another keeper. And it wasn't the fact now it'd be, you know, you can't play, you know. I had to play. Yeah. And then I'd be playing a first team game on the Saturday, and that's how it was. You know, you looked at the squad when we trained, we had 14 players sometimes, and only one of those was a goalkeeper.
Yeah. So you didn't have second day recovery, third day recovery, fourth day recovery.
Nothing like that. But like I say, I think that Dave Bassett looked and thought, well, listen, this man's going to be playing every week.
Yeah.
So he's going to be playing. So he's now got how many games under my belt I had, and he's got the experience, and he's been at the club for a long time, and he's got the respect for the other lads, and he's got the maturity probably that although when there was something that was going on, I was normally involved in it. but the fact was that I was the go-between between the manager and the players and the other way around, between the players and the manager. You know, if there was a problem, I'd go to the manager, and if the manager had a problem, he'd come to me and I'd get it sorted out.
Yeah, well, before we talk, because I really want to talk about the cup final, of course, but you just touched on there that you didn't miss a game from, I believe, 1981 all the way through to 1990. We had Brad Friedel on the show recently, and he set a record in the Premier League of 310 consecutive games. You must have been there or thereabouts, if not more.
I think I was probably more, but obviously his was Premiership game, which was a fantastic feat, and I know Brad, and he's a great lad and a tremendous goalkeeper as well. And I think if the records probably be the same, because you know we used to, like I say, play week in, week out, didn't have the squad rotation as you do now for cup games as well. So you know you'd get the number of games under your belt, and I think I was about six short of Steve Grzegorzewicz's consecutive record, and I had a spiral when I was playing for Chelsea. I had a spiral fracture of my finger, which meant I missed. I don't know how many games I missed, but you know, I was short of the record, so I do know that I haven't got it. But I think Steve Grzegorzewicz has still got the consecutive record.
Yeah, interesting. Well, I want to talk to you about the cup final, of course, beating Liverpool. Wimbledon 1, Liverpool 0. The first penalty save in an FA Cup final. The first goalkeeper to be captain in an FA Cup final. Also, it was the last FA Cup final to be broadcast by both the BBC and ITV at the same time.
That's a fact I didn't know. So.
There you go. We've done our research. But yeah,
I mean, first
and foremost, that penalty save, and I believe I read somewhere that obviously the penalty was given, and because you were trying to calm down the players going a little bit crazy, you were trying to calm down the players, that when the penalty was actually taken, you were shattered and you were panting from trying to chase the players and calm them down.
Yeah, it's strange to say something like that when I've probably run around for about 20 seconds and the other lads have to do it for 90 minutes. But it was a situation where, you know, we've seen the footage afterwards. It wasn't a penalty. We all knew it wasn't a penalty, you know, and it was given, and it was, obviously it could have damaged our day. And all the players were chasing. I was chasing the referee, Brian Hill, chasing all over the place. And then I said, well, I've got to, you know, face this penalty. And I can remember standing on the goal line, just bending down, hands on my legs, and thinking, you know, calm yourself down, breathe properly, and go through all the process which you thought about and talked about with, you know, if you had to face a penalty from John Aldridge.
Yeah, and you did your research. I mean, something that is a given now, and of course we've heard of different stories. I think Ben Foster with an iPad and Jordan Pickford writing things on a water bottle. But you had done your research prior to the penalty, and you'd already made your decision as to where you were going to dive for that particular penalty.
Yeah, more or less. It was, you know, nowadays we see every game on TV, every goal, every penalty is seen. So, you know, you've got the opportunity to have it logged, to have, you know, every penalty from every Liverpool player. You could put on an iPad, study it for a week and know exactly where each individual, because if he wasn't taking the penalty, if it was Peter Beardsley, if it was Alan Hansen taking it, I would know, you know, nowadays where they were doing it. But in those days, we didn't see every game. And unfortunately for me, Liverpool were that good that on match of the day, it was generally a Liverpool team that were playing against a different opposition. So I had the chance to probably see them eight or nine times in the season and seen the penalties, because we didn't have analysts in those days. Although, I say Wimbledon were quite advanced, we did have somebody who would come in and cut clips of games for us. And, you know, so it was, again, something that people probably didn't give Wimbledon credit for, that we were doing things like that years ago. But not for penalties. It wasn't that type of thing. So I'd seen John Aldridge, seen his penalties he'd taken, see him take one in the semi-final against Forest. And that wasn't actually semi-final, it was a league game. And seeing what he'd done, and just thinking that if he'd come up, and John Motson, in the week prior to the cup, you know, the cup final was huge in those days. You know, the gloss has gone off it a little bit now. In those days, once you know, our league form, once we got to the final, went out the window. It was amazing how we were, you know, I think we still finished up sixth or seventh in the league of the season we won the cup. But we had gone really well. But between the semi-final and the final, we didn't win a game. We didn't lose many, but we drew. So the edge, I think, had been taken off us, because we were now thinking and preparing for the cup final. And the week prior, everything started. The media came down. You'd done your open days for the press. You'd done open days for fans. We had the clothes show. It was a TV program, which was a fashion thing going around in those days. And we had them come down because we had our suits made, and it's like a fashion parade. And John Motson on the open day was talking to me and saying, you know, I knew I was the first goalkeeper to captain a team in Wembley final. And so obviously he was saying, if you win the final, then you'll be the first goalkeeper to go and receive the trophy. And he said, and you know, there's never, you know, John Aldridge hasn't missed a penalty this season, and there's never been a penalty saved in a final. So, you know, what would you do if John Aldridge happened to get a penalty? And I said that, you know, exactly what he said. I've researched him as much as I can, and he comes up and he tends to do this little, I called it a stutter. So he just kind of half slowed down a yard or so before. And in that situation, the keeper sometimes committed himself. And if the keeper committed himself, then he'd see which way he's going and obviously put the ball the other way. But if the keeper hadn't committed himself, he tended to go to the goalkeeper's left. That was his side of favour. And that's what I felt I would do in the cup final. I would stay as still as possible till he was about to kick the ball, then dive to my left. But in seeing the footage, I didn't stand still till he kicked the ball. I started to move beforehand. And, you know, he put it to the side that I decided I was going to go, and that's the history.
And John Motson, he mentioned it in the commentary, didn't he?
He was more or less, as, you know, they were preparing to, John Aldridge was preparing to take the penalty. He was saying, oh, and Dave told me in the week that John Aldridge would come up and he would, and he saved it. You know, so,
brilliant.
He was kind of preempting what John Aldridge was going to do, because I had said this is what he's going to do, and it's one of Motty's greatest commentary moments.
And I've got to ask you, because we get a lot of young goalkeepers listen to this, and I remember as a kid you're practicing in the garden or in the park and you're thinking about what it would be like playing in big games, and of course every kid dreams of winning a cup final, but not only to do it, not only to captain, to save the penalty, keep a clean sheet, beat Liverpool. Was that the single greatest moment of your life?
Yeah, I mean, football-wise, yeah, most definitely. You know, the fact that, as you quite rightly said, you know, cup final, I can remember seeing all the great captains and, you know, going up those steps, lifting the trophy, getting it and raising it to their fans, and thinking, you know, if only that, you know, that was a dream. Mm. A dream. You never, ever think it was going to happen. And the fact that, and I was put in that position, to be that fortunate, it was a dream come true. Yep, you're right.
Yeah, and a lot of people might not recall, but it was actually your last game that you played for Wimbledon. You're only 29 at the time, and in some ways, it was the real start of your career, certainly in the top flight. After you left Wimbledon, you went to Newcastle. A record at the time, about, was it £750,000?
850 it was at the time, and that, as you've said, that, you know, strange with all the figures that go around now, that was a British record for a goalkeeper. I think Phil Parks of QPR, when he went to West Ham, was, I think he was about 550, and so that, you know, dwarfed that figure when you think of the, hundreds of thousands compared to the millions. But yeah, it was a goalkeeping record at the time.
But you were only there for a brief time. Can you sum up your time at Newcastle?
Yeah, I mean, funny that Newcastle actually came in for me during the season we won the cup, but they came in at Christmas time, and because of the transition that Wimbledon were going through from Dave Bassett, who was, my manager from when I signed for him, he was my reserve team manager. Darrell Grady was a manager, and then Dave Bassett, progressing to manager, and then him being my manager through the fourth division, the third division, the second division, the first division, and then him leaving, and suddenly there's a big part of the club going, and then you look to the reason why he left, and you're thinking, and Dave Bassett said, I've taken Wimbledon as far as I can go, to go from, the fourth division to the first division, top flight. You can't better that. And little did he know, the next season we could better that, because we were in a top flight, and then we go and win in the FA Cup. But I was of the same mentality that, I wanted to play at the top. When you get into football, you want to play at the best level you possibly can. And I can remember, being at Wimbledon and Stoke City came in for me, and they were in their first division. And I was desperate to play at the top. And Dave Bassett was, he was a man of psychology in those days, even back then. And he would say to me, you think you can go there? Okay. Well, if you go, I'm going to get another goalkeeper. We go to tribunal, I'll get another goalkeeper in. Mm. And I just had that doubt. I had that doubt that if it's going to go, because they couldn't agree a fee for me, so it was going to go to tribunal. And I had that doubt, if they don't pay the money for me, he's going to get another goalkeeper. And if there's someone else in the team, I might not be playing. So it played tricks with my mind. And in the end, I spoke with Stoke City. We met up at, I can't remember, the service station, somewhere near Derby, up the M1. Mm. And because they said it was going to go to a tribunal, I said, look, I can't risk the fact that if the tribunal set the fee too high, you can't pay it. Wimbledon will have got another goalkeeper and I could be left in limbo. So in the end, I didn't go to Stoke. But it was the fact that I wanted to play at the top level, and given that chance, I had that mentality during the season of 88, thinking Newcastle came in for me. What a big club Newcastle are. I wouldn't mind going there. Mm. And Bobby Gould said at the time, come back with £1 million. It had never been heard of. Mm. Never been heard of £1 million for a goalkeeper.
Yeah, well, and amazing to think that had you left earlier in the season, then obviously the FA Cup, talking about it being your greatest moment as a professional footballer, that might not have happened.
Exactly. So, sometimes, that's the proof, I suppose, that the grass isn't always greener. On the other side of the fence. So, it worked out that I stayed, we won the cup, and then I got, the big money moved to Newcastle. And as you say, I signed a 5-year contract at Newcastle. It wasn't going great up there. I mean, from a personal point of view, it was okay. I was quite busy, but we were struggling as a club. There was a boardroom battle going on and someone who'd done wonders for the club, Sir John Hall. He was trying to get onto the board of the club. The club was owned by two brothers, the Seymour brothers, and there was just this shares battle going on. And so suddenly it got to a situation where they had to sell their assets, the owners of the club, because there was a slew issue going on. And I was like the last in and first out, and I was classed as the asset. And I left for Chelsea then the fee went down from 850 to 750. So I went to Newcastle for 850, went from Newcastle to Chelsea for 750.
There's a couple of things I want to talk to you about your time at Chelsea. The first one, you touched on it, the fact the pass-back rule came in. There's some classic footage, actually, of you, a ball coming back to you, deflected back, and you're asking the ref, can I pick it up, can I pick it up, which you did, and then he blew for an indirect free kick.
Yeah.
How did the pass-back rule coming in affect you? Did it change your game much?
Well, I think it changed everyone's game because, in those days, you had a strong foot, and that was it. That was the foot you kicked with. Nowadays, you work on your bad foot, and you see so many goalkeepers. They don't look like they've got a bad foot. They've got a foot they prefer to kick the ball with, but they haven't really got a bad foot. Whereas, in those days, my left foot was a bad foot. If the ball sometimes, or I had the chance, and the ball was coming towards my left foot, I would even cut across it with my right foot and hit it with the outside of my right foot because I knew I was going to get an elevation on the ball. It would go a distance, whereas with my left foot, I'm thinking, I've got to get the ball in the air. I've got to make sure I don't get too much under it because it could just go up in the air. So, you know, it affected me in the fact that you had to adjust certain things in your game.
And secondly, I want to talk to you about, I'm sure it was a tough time in your career, and certainly I don't think we've ever had a goalkeeper on here that has gone their whole career without making a couple of major errors in their time. And it sounds like a really tough time for you against Oldham and Norwich, a couple of errors that were picked out by manager Ian Porterfield. In fact, he was quite publicly yeah. scathing in his comments about you. How was that time for you, and how was the conversation with Ian Porterfield? How do you feel about it now?
It's still a very, very sour, and you know, it leaves a bitter taste in my mouth, the thought of it, and the thought that it just wouldn't happen now, and it shouldn't have happened then. You know, I think the Oldham game was probably a few weeks before, and that was actually a miskick on my left foot, I think. Mm. And they put it in from just inside our half. They scored, and we were leading 1-0 up until late in the game. But the main game was Norwich at home, and it was a situation that I didn't want to say at the time, but I wasn't right for the game, and the manager knew about it, and the physio knew. But like I was saying about goalkeepers, I was the only first-team goalkeeper. We had Nick Colgan, who went on to have a good career, but he'd never played. He was a young lad. And I'd woke up in the morning, and I had this, and it was this inner ear balance thing where I was just feeling dizzy. I couldn't keep my eyes open. And I'd been sick in the morning. And I come in to the manager. I said, I don't feel right. Get some Vicks on your chest, and you know, you'll be there, clear your head, you'll be okay. And we're 2-0 up in the first half. And going great, and but then in the second half, again I come in half time, so I just don't feel right. You know, you've got to go in with more Vicks. I made two mistakes in the game, two soft goals. The winning goal was a really soft. I can still see it. Yeah, shot from outside the box. No real great power. The ball hit a couple of bobbles, bounced up in the air, and I've read it's going to bounce again. And my dive is a bit higher than, you know, obviously being flat on the ground, and the ball hasn't bounced, it's gone flat and under my body and rolled into the net. And we end up losing the game 3-2. And, you know, you come in, and as a goalkeeper, you know when you make mistakes. The players know. Sometimes they don't have to say anything. Sometimes you come and say, lads, I'm sorry. And that's what it was. And the next thing, I just sat in the bath for ages. And then then Peter Nicholas, who was a player, said, oh, the manager wanted to see you, but he's gone to do the press. And that was it. Literally, I got out of the bath, got changed, didn't even go into the players' bar, which was the normal in those days, the players' bar after game. Got in the car, drove home. And then on news at 10, it said that, and I was shocked, I was getting phone calls from everybody. It said that Ian Porterfield had said, you know, that I was sacked. The way it came over on the news was, you know, sensation. Dave Pearson had been sacked by Chelsea. The manager said he would never play for the club again.
Which is extraordinary. Like you said, that would never happen today. The bit that I'll never fully understand is, and this happens, by the way, and this is where I know a lot of the keepers listening in will relate to this, is you never go into a game thinking, I'm going to make a mistake today. And there'll be many games. I remember a similar situation I had where I had a bout of insomnia, and I remember going in the morning and telling the manager, and the manager still choosing to play me. Thankfully, I just about got through the game, and if I remember rightly, we edged a win. But I remember thinking, no one else knows this except me and you. Yeah. And I look like a bit of an idiot today because I'm shattered, haven't slept in 48 hours. I'm having to play in front of 20,000 people. Like, it was just a horrible, horrible feeling. But it was almost feeling like, well, I can't. If he's telling me I have to play, I have to play. But it's only me and you that know that. So for him to then come out and publicly do that, did you speak to him afterwards and have a conversation and have it out with him?
It got to the situation that, and it shouldn't have got to the situation. Like I said, you know, first of all, the manager, he should have known what my situation was, and he should have actually, in a way, stuck up for you and saying, you know, that before the game, you know, the player had said he wasn't well, but we had to play him. And yeah, he made a mistake. And yeah, I'm going to take him out of the team for a bit, but not the way that he was led into saying it. And I say that, unfortunately, it got to the situation, obviously, on the Monday, I've come in to train, and we've nearly come to blows. the fact that Peter Nicholas was there has stopped it getting to the situation where we were going to be at each other. Mm. And it's tough. And the thing was then, you know, because of that situation arising, I wasn't allowed to train with the first team.
Right.
So it's not just the fact that he's you know, come out and more or less publicly, you know, told everyone, you're finished at this football club. I wasn't allowed to train with the first team. And then I had this self-conscious feeling and self-consciousness that whenever I went out, because of my size, everyone was looking at me. Mm. They weren't. They probably didn't even know who I was. But the fact that was, if I went out and I was standing out above people, I'm thinking, they're probably thinking, there's the goalkeeper's been sacked. Mm. And it did. It really played. It really got to me. And the week after Porterfield had said this, Wolves wanted me on loan, to go out on loan. So it shows that other people had lost faith and confidence in what you could do. Mm. But I had suddenly lost confidence in myself.
Yeah.
Because of how it happened. And I was thinking, I can't go on loan. I can't go there, because if I make a mistake there now, then people are going to, you know, just put, it's the snowball getting bigger and bigger. Mm. And the effect on me getting bigger and bigger. So I wouldn't go on loan. And there was a few clubs that came in for me on loan. But I turned them down until it got to a situation where, because of me training, I wasn't working with the first team, I was working with the reserves. I built my self-esteem and my self-confidence back up again. And unfashionable Grimsby, and the manager there was Alan Buckley, and he said to me, look, you know, I want you to come on loan. And I, you know, when you think about, there was Wolves and there was other clubs that were interested, I decided to go to Wolves, to Grimsby, because I looked at their fixtures. Mm. And I looked at their fixtures and I thought, massive game against Grimsby, because it was the season where Newcastle started the season and they went 12 straight wins. Mm. And the 13th, I think it was the 13th or 12th game, was Grimsby playing Newcastle at St James Park. Mm. And that's one of the reasons why I signed for Grimsby, because the games, I'm thinking, right, these are big games, and these are games where people are going to look, and they're going to be looking to see my reaction and how I do. And we went to St James Park. We won 1-0. When I joined Grimsby at the beginning of the month, they were 18th in the league. When I left them 6 games later, they were 6th in the league. Mm. Alan Buckley wanted me to stay on, and I said, Alan, it's been a fantastic for me to be here, and I think it's worked both ways. I've got to go back to Chelsea now, because I want to be there to be in the manager's face, so he can't really look past me anymore.
Yeah. Do you know what? It's fascinating. I want to touch on this a little bit more, because, essentially, I guess you chose a position where there was nothing to lose. You had everything to gain. You know, I look at situations at the moment, like I was questioning if, let's say, Alisson were to get injured for Liverpool and Mignolet had to then step into his shoes, how difficult it is to gain plaudits, because people are almost out for you because you're stepping into such big shoes, or you've got positivity behind your negativity. You know, I remember a personal example, and I might have spoke about this before on this show, where essentially I made the error that cost us in a playoff semi-final, and it took me, I would say, at least 6 months to get over that. I went from first choice to third choice. I had a slight injury, but at the time I made it last a bit longer than it should have lasted. I remember felt drained of confidence, and certainly at the time Twitter was coming into the world and everybody could get in touch with you instantly. How long did that incident and that time, how long did it take you to rebuild your self-esteem?
Well, that's like I'm saying, it took me the six weeks, and very, very fortunate that, you know, social media wasn't in, the mobile phones weren't around so much then, so you didn't have all this the public where it's part of the, you know, you're part of their domain, other than the fact that they go watch a game, 30 20 25 10 15 whatever, how many thousand people are there, that's when they're there. And you always feel that, you know, they're there to make their opinions of you. But then, like I say, for a period of time, it wasn't just in that environment. I'd be walking down the street and you don't think people are going to shout things at you. They didn't shout things, but it was in my mind. I'm thinking that people are going to be looking, oh, there's that goalie that's been sacked. Mm. That goalie who made a mistake. Mm. So it did. It took me a while to get my self-esteem back and my self-confidence back, and then knowing that I'm going to now go and show you And it was a point of, I'm going to show you, not show everybody, I'm going to show you. And that one you was the manager.
Yeah. Again, I'm sure every goalkeeper listening can relate. I certainly had a similar one with an ex-manager at Brentford, where it's amazing how much of a drive that can be, where you want to show someone just how good you are. Next up, your next club, Southampton. Before we speak about Southampton, got to ask you, salad cream. Can you talk us through exactly what happened?
I can. Again, it's like the cup final. I can remember every minute of it. You know? It was, again, it was a situation which the press, the media had a laugh at your expense. But it was amazing. And for something that I used to do every morning was make a cup of tea. So before training, before anything I'd done, I got up and for this reason, I can't understand why I had quite a deep larder in my house. And for some reason, I used to keep the tea bags at the back of the larder. Rather than you think, if you use it every day, they should be at the front.
Yeah.
And as I reached to the back one day, I knocked a jar of salad cream, which was at the front. And it was a jar. And the irony is, my brother used to work at Heinz's.
Right.
So we'd always have jars of salad cream, tins of baked beans, everything, soups. We had everything from Heinz's you could possibly think of. Jar of salad cream. So as I've knocked this jar of salad cream, my hands are in the cupboard because I'm getting the tea bags out. So my natural instinct, and probably anyone, would be when something's falling to the floor, is to try and break, as a footballer, try and break its fall, try and control it. So the jar's travelling to the floor. I've got no shoes or socks on because I've just got out of bed, and I've got to control it. It's hit my foot, bounced off my foot, and then broke on the floor. But I've got a little cut, probably about a half inch cut across. And now this and this, again, you've got a picture, the fact that there's salad cream, which is, we all know what colour salad cream is. We all know what colour blood is.
Yeah.
And now the blood is mixing with the salad cream and looking like Thousand Island dressing. But so it's bleeding. I've got a half inch cut. And I'm thinking, I'm going to get this stitched now because, it's quite deep. And so I went to my doctor's. And doctor said, I don't like the look of that. I'm thinking, surely you just stick a couple of stitches in it. He went, no, I think you've got to go to hospital. Because he told me to try and to move my big toe, and I couldn't move it. So what had happened is from where you curl your foot up to, control the ball as such, but the bottle, your tendons are tightened.
Right.
And the jar has gone through, severed the tendon and gone to my bone. So the tendon, so I have to go to a hospital, and the irony was I go to a hospital and I had to see a surgeon. I was in Wexham Park, and the surgeon there says, I said, look, I've got to ring my manager. When he tells me I've got to have surgery, I said, I've got to ring my manager. I hadn't spoken to Glenn Hoddle. He's going to be our new manager for the next season.
Yeah.
Never spoke to him, and so my first phone call was, Glenn, I'm in the hospital and I've got to have surgery. And the surgeon's going, oh, is that your manager? I said, yeah. He said, well, is it Glenn Hoddle? I said, yeah. Can I speak to him? He just wanted to speak. He didn't care about me. Suddenly he wanted to speak to Glenn Hoddle. So, obviously Glenn relayed to the surgeon. I couldn't have it done there. I've got to have it done in, the Chelsea Total Hospital where they have their surgeries done. And, I'd like to have an S cut into my foot. So as obviously where the tendons are like an elastic band where it shrinks off. So they had to go in and find the ends of them, pull them together, stitch them together, and then they stuck a 4-inch pin in the end of my toe through the bone. So it was my toe would stay up in the air. And then they left about probably half an inch of the pin sticking out the end of my toe. So it was like something out of James Bond, when they're, they walk past and have the poison at the end and kick them in the shin and they die from it. So I'd go walking around and I'd have bits of toffee crisp paper and crisp papers sticking on the end of my toes. I was collecting up all the litter for everybody.
Oh, nightmare. How long were you out for?
That was my worst ever injury, which was, I was out for 3 months, which, like I say, was a week before the start of the season, pre-season, sorry, not the start of the season. So, and Glenn had just come to the club. So Glenn had the choice. We had an easy choice. He didn't have to take me into the equation. Dimitri Karin was at the club by this time. So Dimitri Karin started in goal. And Kevin Hitchcock was a reserve keeper. And Hitchie was, he was a great second choice. You know, he could have probably been a first choice keeper, but he tended to make his career as a number two, which you see a lot of goalkeepers. They, you know, they have a long career, but when you look at the number of games they play, they don't play that many. But you know, Hitchie was a very good, you know, at Chelsea. Whenever someone was out, he came in, done really well, and then would be out the team again because the other person tended to get the nod and get back in the team. But you know, Hitchie never, I don't think, let anyone down when he played in the first team at Chelsea. And like I say, Hitchie had started the season as well with Chelsea. So when it comes to me getting myself fit, the two goalkeepers were there, were in position and doing very well. So fortunately for me, Southampton came in and made an offer for me. And I was that type of keeper that I wanted to play football, even though, you know, Chelsea were a great club for me. If I wasn't playing first team football, I didn't want to be there. So, you know, I moved on to Southampton.
And a quick word on Kevin Hitchcock, on Hitchie. He was, in fact, and someone that I'm personally very thankful for. He took me under his wing as the coach of Watford, took me up to Blackburn, and essentially, in my opinion, gave me a career. And I know you guys were very close, of course, when you came to Watford for that short period of time. I could tell that you were very close. And you're right, Hitchie actually made me watch a few of his clips when he played for Chelsea, and he did. He produced some fantastic saves. Just never seemed like he really was given a prolonged period in the team. It was always just filling in.
Yeah, exactly that. And I was, that's, as you know, that's the reason I came to Watford, because, you know, at the age I was when I was coming into training with you, and Hitchie obviously as the coach, because it's quite a local club for me, you know, Hitchie done me a favour by allowing me to come in, work with you guys and get myself fit. Which again, you always, you know, appreciate the fact you've got mates in the game, and they allow you to be able to do that. So, yeah, and it got enabled me to meet you, Rich.
There you go. There you go. The silver lining and all that. Southampton, of course, you went there, and it was you and Bruce Grobler, which at the time you had two goalkeepers with a combined age of 72.
Yeah, I mean, well, I was there before Bruce, and you know, we had a few managers in that period. Now, I signed for Ian Brantford, who, you know, didn't go down very well with the fans at Southampton. And now I'm just trying to think. It was Branny, and then I think it was Laurie McMenemy and Alan Ball came in. And, you know, me and Bally didn't actually hit it off at the beginning. And like I say, in those days, and you probably know, Richard, well, the culture was slightly different to today, you know, with how the players behaved off the field a little bit, and especially with my background with Wimbledon as well. We fell out over a pre-season drinking episode where I'd done something I shouldn't have done. And the manager said, well, I'm going to bring someone else in. And he brought Bruce Grobler in over when we was in Holland. And the irony is that because now he brought Bruce in, I've done it again and gone out again with a few of the other players. And while I'm out, we're having a drink, and the next thing is Bruce Grobler's come riding through the bar on a bike with someone on the handlebars, and he was in the bar with us. So, you know, he just added someone who would act very similar to myself and be a close friend. And yeah, Bruce was a good lad, but he had that period where, you know, he was involved in the bung scandal again with Fash, and that made it a difficult period for Bruce at the club as well.
What was Bruce like as a character?
He's a fantastic player. He had all these stories. You don't know whether they were all true, but, you know, we'd tell you that he was in the jungle and he'd had fights with, you know, alligators, and you know, he's been with all these wild animals because obviously he's from South Africa, and you know, but they were fantastic stories. So he had you on the end of every word he was saying, and then you get to the end, you think, that can't be true. But he was brilliant. Yeah, Bruce is a great character.
Brilliant. You touched earlier in the podcast, you mentioned that you felt like you got better and better with age, and even at 38 years old going to Forest, you made over 100 appearances for Forest, and arguably it was one of your best times.
Again, you know, like I enjoyed all my clubs that I was at, and people say, "What's your best club?" And it must be Wimbledon. Wimbledon was unique, but you know, going to these other clubs, and I think that people would always say, "Oh, what's it like, you know, being in that dressing room?" And we had probably in a team of 11, we had 7 or 8 characters. Now, every club had at least one of those characters. And, you know, you've always got them. And so whenever I went into a club, you kind of found that person and you bounced off them, and it added to the atmosphere in the dressing room and the camaraderie. And I had that at Forest. We had a great time. And Dave Bassett, again, was my manager. He took me up there. He took me up there on loan, first of all, from Southampton. Mm. And I went up there, and my 1 month loan turned into 3 months loan. I'm thinking, Harry, if you don't know me by now, you're never going to know me. But I don't think he was in a position where he could just go out and sign me, because they had a Swiss international, Marco Pascal.
Yeah.
He was a Swiss international goalkeeper who was there, and he was injured at the time. But he had a tough time at Forest. And so when I got there and come into the team and started doing well, because Forest were in the Championship then, and I signed and had a good season, and it ended up with that season we got promoted to the Premier Division.
I've got to ask you, you made 2 England appearances. In fact, you had 2 clean sheets.
Yeah, that's one. You know, I played at Wembley 4 times and haven't let a goal in. So
that's got to be some kind of record.
Yeah, when people say, what's your favourite stadium? And you say Wembley Stadium, they say, oh, that's, you know, I suppose if you're a Tottenham player, you could say that. But the fact that I played there, you know, 4 times and not let a goal in, it's something that I was proud of. Although with the England caps, I didn't start the games. I came on the subs for Shields. But yeah, that was another, you know, unbelievable experience to play for your country. And thinking, again, you know, with Wimbledon, would I have got to that chance to play for England? I don't know. I mean, Don Howe was England coach, and when he came into Wimbledon, because Bobby Gould brought him in, and we sat down and had a chat, because obviously I was saying to, when Bobby Gould came into the club, I said to you that I was thinking, you know, have I got to move on to try and go to the next level? And the next level would be to have a chance of playing for England and to play for a big club. And Don Howe sat me down one day and he said, you know, Dave, listen, you know, you've been in our thoughts when we've had our meetings of our goalkeepers. He says, your name is always mentioned. Mm. And then to get that chance to play and to make your debut against a country such as Italy, it was unbelievable. But with all this, when you're trying to be as focused as you possibly can, when we came out to warm up at half time, you know, because I knew I was coming on, I'd come out and warmed up at half time. And in those days with the England internationals, as you had with the Wembley Cup finals, you had the marching bands on the pitch with the white helmets on. Mm. And there was, you know, I don't know, 10 abreast and 10 deep, and then marching up and down a pitch. And then to see Gazza pinging balls into the middle of the band to see what if he could take someone's head, you know, hat off their head. And I'm thinking, I'm trying to focus here, Gazza, and I'm watching you hit balls into the band.
And of course, you went to the 1990 World Cup. You mentioned earlier, obviously, it was before the time of mobile phones and social media or whatever. Am I right in thinking that they had some difficulty getting hold of you to let you know that you were in the squad for the 1990 World Cup?
Yeah, because, you know, we at the end of the season, you know, you start your get-together in preparation. So it's, but there, and there was 26 of us that had a training a couple of weeks. We was based at Burnham Beaches Hotel. We used to train at Bisham Abbey. And then you know that the numbers are going to be cut, and there was 4 of you not going to go. And you know, I always felt that I was the outside of the 4. You know, the outside of the goalkeepers. Yeah, so the 4 goalkeepers, I was going to be one. And I used to room with Dave Seaman. And I can remember the day that, you know, we knew it was going to be told. And there's a knock on the door, and Bobby Robson's come in our room, and there's me and Dave Seaman. And... And this is Bobby Robson. Bobby said to me, he looked at me and he said, Dave, I've got some great news for you. And you could see Dave Seaman's face drop. Mm. And he's looking at me and I'm thinking, what? And he went, you don't have to train anymore. He went, you can have a rest now. And that was his way of breaking it to me. And you know, you see like a relief on Dave Seaman's face. And yeah, I was one along with Tony Adams, I think Alan Smith, and the late David Rokar saw that, you know, so there's three Arsenal and myself that were left out of the squad. And so, you had to somehow keep fit, but I didn't have anywhere to train. Didn't have a goalkeeping coach where I was going to go training with him two times a week to keep my eye and hand coordination in. I just go for a run. And on this day, I was out playing golf. And I was on the golf course playing. I think it was Dave Bassett's golf day, in fact. And I was playing golf. And then when I got in, there's people, Dave, you've got to go. You've got to go to World Cup. And I was like, what are you talking about? And it was on Teletext, or CFAX, as it was known in those days. And it was on there saying, you know, Bolly Robson is looking to try and get in touch with Dave Besson because, you know, Dave Seaman's injured his thumb and he's being called up to the World Cup. So, yeah, it came about in a strange way. And suddenly, you think, well, I better get home and start packing my suitcase.
That's fantastic. I miss the days of Teletext. I used to check that religiously. 301, I think it was.
Yeah, exactly.
Last couple of questions. I got to ask you, you were very nearly the oldest player to have ever played in English football. You were named on the bench for Stevenage in 2015 for a playoff semi-final against Southend. You were 56 years old. Did you ever consider that you might get on?
Well, it got to the situation where I joined Stevenage because my son was there. Sam was there, and Graham Wesley was the manager. He didn't have a goalkeeping coach, and I said I'd come in and help a couple of days a week. Yeah. And me being me, those couple of days went to, I was there every day of the week. And unfortunately, my son had he had to go to hospital. He had a burst appendix.
Oh, right.
Just as we're getting towards the end of the season. So they only had Chris Day, who was probably 39 at the time, and myself. And I'd join in a few training sessions. And the irony was, whenever I joined in training, this isn't like bigging myself up here, Rich. My team used to always win, and Graham Weston used to love it. He'd get the boys together and he'd say, how come with an old fella like him in goal, an old grandad like him in goal, and they keep winning? Why do they keep winning? And, you know, and he's saying because of he's talking, you know, he understands his organisation. He's organising things in front so he doesn't have to do too much.
Yeah.
Which is right, you know, that's what I say, as you get older, you understand, you get people in the right positions, you know when to come for balls, whereas before you're thinking anything there was, you know, you was told anything come in the box is your ball. And you know when to come, when not to come. But, yeah, so it got to the situation where, I'll say Sam was laid up with his operation for appendicitis, and I had been training. So suddenly for about 10 days consecutive, I had to train every day. And like you're saying, I was 55, 56, and I was on the bench. And I actually said to Graham Wesley, I said, man, to be fair, if I'm on the bench, you might as well play me.
Yeah.
I said, because, you know, and this is no disrespect to Daisy, Chris Day, but then you had our joint age was 97, I think, between the two of us. Two goalkeepers, 97. That was quite unbelievable.
Amazing. It's an interesting point, though, and again, for our goalkeepers that listen in, and it's something that I feel now maybe isn't given as much value as it needs to, that the fact that you can stop so much at source if you are a good communicator.
Yeah, definitely. But, you know, and I understood this in my career because, you know, when I went to Fulham, my transition from playing to coaching, it was as smooth as anything. But I still had that mentality that I was a player. And I can remember Chris Coleman was, you know, he gave me the opportunity to coach, and he said he spoke to a few people and they kind of recommended me as a coach. Although I'd never done it before, they thought that I'd make a coach. And I had 5 great years at Fulham with Chris Coleman. And he said, you know, I want you as player coach. And that was a massive thing to me, to be player coach rather than just coach. And I was 42 at the time. Mm. And then he said to me, right, this is a staff dressing room. And I said, no, I'm going in the player's dressing room. Mm. And he said, no. And then he realised how important it was that I was in the dressing room, because, you know, you started to find out, like you say, it can be a little quicky. We did have, you know, we had a few French boys in the team, and they were very much we sit together and we talk there. The other boys sit together. And I made sure I sat in the middle of the French boys. So that was it. And I loved them. I loved the French lads. And we got on great. And then for 3 years, I was player coach. And then suddenly you got to that stage where I'm thinking, right, now's the time for me to say maybe my better playing days are beyond me. But it got to the situation where on my 45th birthday, I was on the bench at Stamford Bridge against Chelsea. And again, you know, it was a game where I'm thinking, I better start warming up in front of the manager here because he can put me on, you know, just for the fact that it's at Chelsea. I'm 45 today and I think he should put me on the pitch.
Yeah, oh, fantastic. And last but not least, the perm. Talk us through the perm.
Well, there you go, Rich, because this is now where, you know, we're going to talk truth. It was never permed. The perms were in thing in those days, and I was quite fortunate that I had curly hair. And I look back at
fortunate?
The photograph
is fortunate
now.
The word?
Well, in those days, yeah, because I didn't have to pay to have curly hair, which a perm in those days was probably about 40 quid, which is quite a lot of money in those days. So, yeah. And you know, you see the Keegans, the Terry McDermott, I can't think of what else, but everyone had perms, and mine was just naturally perm, not perm, shaggy, I'd say. So, yeah, I got away with it. But then again, I look now and people do say, oh, God, you must have been embarrassed about that haircut. And I say, well, when you look at the times, it was quite a fashionable thing, and it was a natural one. So, I still get a little bit of stick about it even now.
Yeah, absolutely. And very last question. Obviously, a lot of goalkeeper coaches listen to this on a weekly basis, and delighted to say that our listeners, it's increasing week in, week out. Advice. What advice would you give for a younger goalkeeper coming through that is looking to make it and looking to go and maximise their game, go as far as they can, for all the hundreds of things that you've learned over your years, what advice would you give to a young goalkeeper who's dedicated to make it?
I think I went through it, like I say, at Chelsea, and I think that's where you learn a lot about yourself. And I'd say that always believe in yourself. You know, no matter what happens and what other people might say, you believe what you're capable of doing and just do it, because you're always going to do it to the best of your ability. You know, no matter what level you're at, whether you're, you know, you're semi-professional, whether you're just at Saturday, you're always going to do it to the best of your ability, and do that and believe in what you're doing, and don't just let people knock you, because you know how hard you're working to try and achieve something that, you know, you want to do.
Fantastic. Mr. Dave Besant, it's been an absolute pleasure.
Thanks, Richard.
Well, a massive thank you to the one and only Dave Besant. Some fantastic stories and a massive character of the game. That wraps up yet another week on the Goalkeepers Union podcast. As always, you can get in touch at GK Union on Twitter, GK Union Official on Instagram, or search GK Union on Facebook in association with GK Icon, or send us an email, hello@goalkeepersunion.net.